Section 4, Unions, An American Story. On September 6, 1869, hundreds of miners' wives and children heard the repeated shrill blasts of the Avondale mine's whistle, which signaled an accident. The families ran to the mine's entry and beheld a terrifying sight, hot smoke billowing from the mine shaft. The owners of the Avondale coal mine in Luzerne, Pennsylvania, had not built a second entrance to their mine. Without an escape route, the 100 miners trapped below soon died. Songs to commemorate the disaster later gave voice to the silenced victims. And as their souls ascended to God who gave them breath, they plead against the company whose greed had caused their death. Following the deaths at Avondale, John Siney, an Irish immigrant and union leader, urged his fellow miners to unionize. "Men, if you must die with your boots on, die for your families, your homes, your country, but do not longer consent to die like rats in a trap." Quoted in Labor's Untold Story. Working in the United States. Life for workers in industrial America was difficult. As machines replaced skilled labor, work became monotonous. Workers had to perform highly specific, repetitive tasks and could take little pride in their work. In addition, working conditions were often unhealthy and dangerous. Workers breathed in lint, dust, and toxic fumes. Heavy machines lacking safety devices caused a high number of injuries. Despite the difficult working conditions, industrialism brought about a dramatic rise in the standard of living. While only a few entrepreneurs became rich, real wages earned by the average worker rose about 50% between 1860 and 1890. Despite the rise in the standard of living, the uneven division of income between the wealthy and the working class caused resentment among workers. In 1900, the average industrial worker made approximately 22 cents per hour and worked an average of 59 hours per week. At the same time, an economic phenomenon of the late 1800s made relations between workers and employers even more difficult. Between 1865 and 1897, the United States experienced deflation, or a rise in the value of money. Throughout the late 1800s, deflation caused prices to fall, which increased the buying power of workers' wages. Although companies cut wages regularly in the late 1800s, prices fell even faster, so that wages were actually still going up in buying power. Most workers, however, believed that the companies wanted to pay them less money for the same work, and it made them angry. Eventually, many workers decided that the only way to improve their working conditions was to organize unions. Reading check. Describing. What aspects of industrial life caused frustration for workers in the late 1800s? Early unions. There were two basic types of industrial workers in the United States in the 1800s, craft workers and common laborers. Craft workers had special skills and training. They included machinists, iron molders, stone cutters, glass blowers, shoemakers, printers, carpenters, and many others. Craft workers generally received higher wages and had more control over how they organized their time on the shop floor. Common laborers had few skills and received lower wages. In the 1830s, as industrialism began to spread, craft workers began to form trade unions, unions limited to people with specific skills. By 1873, there were 32 national trade unions in the United States. Among the largest and most successful were the Iron Molders International Union, the International Typographical Union, and the Knights of St. Crispin, the Shoemakers Union. Industry opposes unions. Employers were often forced to recognize and negotiate with trade unions because they represented workers whose skills they needed. However, employers generally regarded unions as illegitimate conspiracies that interfered with their property rights. Owners of large corporations particularly opposed industrial unions, which united all craft workers and common laborers in a particular industry. Companies used several techniques to prevent unions from forming. They required workers to take oaths or sign contracts promising not to join a union, and they hire detectives to go undercover and identify union organizers. Workers who tried to organize a union or strike were fired and placed on a blacklist, a list of troublemakers. Once blacklisted, a laborer could get a job only by changing residence, trade, or even his or her name. If workers formed a union, companies often used a lockout to break it. They locked workers out of the property and refused to pay them. If the union called a strike, employers would hire replacement workers or strike breakers. Political and social opposition. Workers who wanted to organize a union faced several major problems. There were no laws giving workers the right to organize or requiring owners to negotiate with them. Courts frequently ruled that strikes were conspiracies in restraint of trade, for which labor leaders might be fined or jailed. Unions also suffered from the perception that they threatened American institutions. In the late 1800s, the ideas of Karl Marx, called Marxism, had become very influential in Europe. Marx argued that the basic force shaping capitalist society was the class struggle between workers and owners. He believed that workers would eventually revolt, seize control of the factories, and overthrow the government. Marxists claimed that after the revolution, the government would seize all private property and create a socialist society where wealth was evenly divided. Eventually, Marx thought, the state would wither away, leaving a communist society where classes did not exist. Marxism strongly shaped the thinking of European unions. While many labor supporters agreed with Marx, a few supported anarchism. Anarchists believed that society does not need any government. At the time, some believed that with only a few acts of violence, they could ignite a revolution to topple the government. In the late 1800s, anarchists assassinated government officials and set off bombs all across Europe, hoping to trigger a revolution. As Marxist and anarchist ideas spread in Europe, tens of thousands of European immigrants began arriving in the United States. Nativism, anti-immigrant feelings, was already strong in the United States. As people began to associate immigrant workers with revolution and anarchism, they became increasingly suspicious of unions. These fears, as well as the government's duty to maintain law and order, often led officials to use the courts, the police, and even the army to crush strikes and break up unions. Reading check. Identifying. Why were some Americans suspicious of unions? The struggle to organize. Although workers attempted on many occasions to create large industrial unions, they rarely succeeded. In many cases, the confrontations with owners and the government led to violence and bloodshed. In 1868, William Silvis, president of the Iron Molders Union and leader of the National Labor Union, wrote to Karl Marx to encourage Marx's work and express his own hopes. "Our cause is a common one. Go ahead in the good work that you have undertaken until the most glorious success crowns your efforts. Moneyed power is fast eating up the substance of the people. We have made war upon it, and we mean to win it. If we can, we will win through the ballot box. If not, we will resort to sterner means. A little bloodletting is sometimes necessary in desperate causes." Quoted in Industrialism and the American Worker. The Great Railroad Strike of 1877. In 1873, a severe recession known as the Panic of 1873 struck the American economy and forced many companies to cut wages. In July 1877, as the recession continued, several railroads announced another round of wage cuts. This triggered the first nationwide labor protest. The day after the cuts took effect, railroad workers in Martinsburg, West Virginia, walked off the job and blocked the tracks. As word spread, railroad workers across the country walked off the job. The strike eventually involved 80,000 railroad workers in 11 states and affected two-thirds of the nation's railways. Angry strikers smashed equipment, tore up tracks, and blocked rail service in New York, Baltimore, Pittsburgh, St. Louis, and Chicago. The governors of several states called out their militias to stop the violence. In many places, gun battles erupted between the militia and striking workers. Determined to stop the violence, President Hayes ordered the Army to open the railroad between Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. He then sent troops to Chicago, where the strike had paralyzed the entire city. The troops restored order, but by the time the strike ended, more than 100 people lay dead and millions of dollars of property had been destroyed. The Knights of Labor. The failure of the Great Railroad Strike convinced many labor organizers that workers across the nation needed to be better organized. By the late 1870s, enough workers had joined a new organization, the Knights of Labor, to make it the first nationwide industrial union. The Knights called for an 8-hour workday and a government bureau of labor statistics. They also supported equal pay for women, the abolition of child labor, and the creation of worker-owned factories. The Knights' leaders initially opposed the use of strikes, preferring to use boycotts to pressure employers. They also supported arbitration, a process in which an impartial third party helps workers and management reach an agreement. In the early 1880s, the Knights began to use strikes, and they achieved great success initially. After striking Knights convinced one of Jay Gould's railroads to reverse wage cuts in 1885, membership in the union leapt from 100,000 to 700,000 in less than a year. The following year, 1886, marked the peak of their success. In the spring of that year, an event known as the Haymarket Riot undermined the Knights' reputation, and the union rapidly declined. The Haymarket Riot. In the early 1880s, the movement for an 8-hour workday began to build support. In 1886, organizers called for a nationwide strike on May 1st to show support for the idea. On that date, strikes took place in many cities, including Chicago. On May 3rd, a clash between strikers and police in Chicago left one striker dead. The next evening, an anarchist group organized a meeting in Chicago's Haymarket Square to protest the killing. Around 3,000 people gathered to hear the speeches. When police entered the square, someone threw a bomb. The police opened fire and workers shot back. 7 police officers and 4 workers were killed. Police arrested 8 people for the bombing. 7 of those arrested were German immigrants and advocates of anarchism. The incident horrified people across the country. No one knew who threw the bomb. Although the evidence was weak, all 8 men were convicted, and 4 were later executed. Unfortunately for the Knights of Labor, one of the men arrested was a member of the union. The incident badly hurt the Knights' reputation, and they began to lose members rapidly. The Pullman Strike. Although the Haymarket Riot set back the drive to create industrial unions, other labor organizers continued their efforts. In 1893, railroad workers created the American Railway Union, or ARU, under the leadership of Eugene V. Debs. One of the companies the ARU unionized was the Pullman's Palace Car Company. The Pullman Company was based in Illinois. It had built a town named Pullman near its factory and required its workers to live in the town and to buy goods from company stores. In 1893, a depression struck the United States, causing the Pullman Company to slash wages. The wage cuts made it difficult for workers to pay their rent or the high prices at the company stores. In May 1894, after Pullman fired 3 workers who complained, a strike began. In support, the ARU stopped handling Pullman cars all across the United States. The boycott of Pullman cars tied up railroads and threatened to paralyze the economy. Determined to break the union, railroad managers arranged for U.S. mail cars to be attached to the Pullman cars. If the strikers refused to handle the Pullman cars, they would be interfering with the U.S. mail, a violation of federal law. President Grover Cleveland then sent in troops, claiming it was his responsibility to keep the mail running. When a federal court issued an injunction ordering the union to halt the boycott, the strike at Pullman and the ARU both collapsed. Reading check. Analyzing. Why did industrial unions frequently fail in the late 1800s? The American Federation of Labor. Although large-scale industrial unions generally failed in the late 1800s, trade unions continued to prosper. In 1881, delegates from 20 of the nation's trade unions organized the American Federation of Labor, or AFL. The AFL's first leader was Samuel Gompers. His approach to labor relations, which he called plain and simple unionism, helped unions to become accepted in American society. Gompers believed that unions should stay out of politics. He rejected socialist and communist ideas. Rather, he believed that the AFL should fight for small gains, such as higher wages and better working conditions, within the American system. He was willing to use the strike, but preferred to negotiate. Under Gompers' leadership, the AFL had three main goals. First, it tried to convince companies to recognize unions and to agree to collective bargaining. Second, it pushed for closed shops, meaning that companies could only hire union members. Third, it promoted an 8-hour workday. The AFL grew slowly, but by 1900, it was the biggest union in the country with over 500,000 members. Still, at that time, the AFL represented less than 10% of all non-farm workers. Railroad unions represented another 2 to 3%. As the 1900s began, the vast majority of workers remained unorganized, and unions were relatively weak. Reading check. Analyzing. What AFL policies contributed to its growth as a union? Working women. Throughout the 1800s, most wage-earning workers in the United States were men. After the Civil War, the number of women wage earners began to increase. By 1900, women made up more than 18% of the labor force. The type of jobs women did outside the home in the late 1800s and early 1900s reflected society's ideas about what constituted women's work. Roughly one-third of women worked as domestic servants. Another third worked as teachers, nurses, sales clerks, and secretaries. The remaining third were industrial workers, but they were employed in light industrial jobs that people believed appropriate to their gender. Many worked in the garment industry and food processing plants. Regardless of their employment, women were paid less than men even when they performed the same jobs. It was assumed that a woman had a man helping to support her, either her father or her husband, and that a man needed higher wages to support a family. For this reason, most unions, including the AFL, excluded women. In 1903, two woman labor organizers, Mary Kenny O'Sullivan and Lenora O'Reilly, decided to establish a separate union for women. With the help of Jane Addams and Lillian Wall, the founders of the Settlement House movement, they established the Women's Trade Union League, or WTUL, the first national association dedicated to promoting women's labor issues. The WTUL pushed for an 8-hour day, the creation of a minimum wage, an end to evening work for women, and the abolition of child labor. The WTUL also collected funds to support women on strike. Reading check. Comparing. How were female industrial workers treated differently than male workers in the late 1800s?